Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I think for so long, I was just so happy that I didn't end up in prison, which I don't think I was aware then was so close. You know, now I'm like, oh man, there was like a few moments where I remember just kind of sitting there going like, the shit that's in this room right now is 20 to life. I need to get out of here.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
Taxis cost money, food costs money, and rent costs money.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
Bitch, nah, I ain't no killer, you understand me?
I need to talk about more.
You the only man that's ever touched me.
I'm Mahershala Ali, and for Anna Sale. And last year, I saw a movie that I loved. I loved it so much, I've watched it like 3 times, and it's called Blindspotting. It's set in Oakland, California. I'm originally from the Bay Area, and I think Blindspotting captures the Bay Area so well. The film is all about the messy intersection of race and class and rapid gentrification that's happening there right now.
Bro, what the fuck is this green juice shit doing up in here?
It's good for you.
How much?
$10.
What? What is this, the blood of fucking Jesus? The fuck is in it that it costs $10?
Let me get one.
I'm sorry, what?
These are the two best friends at the center of this movie. Colin is the one who just bought the juice. He's a young black guy who recently got out of prison and absolutely doesn't want to go back. Miles is the one with the attitude. He's white, likes to wear a gold grill, and is always, always stirring up trouble. Their friendship is complicated, and I think it represents something I haven't really seen before on screen. The way in which racism, people, culture really naturally mixes and melds together in the Bay Area.
To me, that's a result of, because the Bay is so eclectic, both in like the melting pot that it is, but also like the different, there's really sort of obscure backgrounds that people come from.
This is Rafael Casal. He plays Miles, the white guy in Blindspotting, and he co-wrote the movie too. Like me, he was also born and raised in the Bay Area.
I think there we've developed this muscle to sort of really like take how somebody has given themselves to you and read that as fact.
Right.
Because we really cherish authenticity in the Bay, right?
Yes.
So everyone really guards their authenticity with everything, which means it's out front, which also means that authenticity out front maybe is not packaged for easy consumption. So we're also good at going, oh, you're a white dude, but you got that kind of Southern draw and that hard R. And you're like holding your jeans and you've got, you know, and you're tatted up, but you're not hipster tatted up.
Right.
I know who you are.
Yes.
You're like my boy Paco.
Yes.
He's like that too. He's from East 14th, you know.
Yes.
That cultural meld is fascinating to watch.
Rafael knows firsthand about that particular cultural meld. The actor, writer, poet, and rapper grew up in Berkeley in the 80s and 90s. In a working-class neighborhood with parents of Irish and Spanish-Cuban heritage. He drew on that childhood of growing up white, in a diverse neighborhood when writing his character Miles in Blindspotting.
We always described him as a minority among minorities. Like, that's how he feels. He feels like he's the minority.
right, yeah.
You know, which is at times how I felt growing up around my friends. Was like, but I'm the only dude who looks like me at this sideshow.
Right.
Like, I'm the odd man out.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm scared out of my fucking mind right now.
Yes.
We're doing donuts and cars and everybody's looking at me to make sure I'm here with some people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's my entire upbringing.
Let's talk a little bit about you know, growing up. You described yourself as this sort of rebellious kind of knucklehead to some degree, like growing up, who was sort of inclined to a certain type of trouble. So you have that aspect to you. But then on the other side, you're this poet, lyricist, thinker, with a real activist vein to you. Like, how do those two personalities exist in one person, and when do they sort of converge?
Yeah, still converging. A lot of the sort of younger years of being just like a little street kid was self-defense entirely, right? It's like offense is the best defense. I think I was small, like so super small kid. And so I think you start puffing up and doing stuff to just like send out a warning call to everybody. Like, you know, you might whoop my ass, but but I'm gonna get a hit in, or I'm not, you know, I'm not a pushover.
So you're trying to preempt anything that you could deal with as a result of what you were seeing happening.
Yeah, and little things that had happened to me that I was like, oh, we can't let that keep going. Like, if that happens twice, people see you get pushed around that way, you gotta, you know, push back. And Berkeley High at the time was violent and scary for like an eighth grade little kid going in. You know, I remember when you got to like my first day of Berkeley High, I remember like walking into like from back from lunch or something, just saw like 20 bloods beat the shit out of some kids from another school who came there to jump somebody. And I just watched this and was like, this is where I go to school, you know, and I'm tiny.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at like my old skater friends who are like just folding over and living in fear.
Yeah.
And so I really found this misfit group of people throughout high school that were like, we just kept each other safe. Mm. And part of that safety was, you know, just doing what like young, rebellious people do when they get a group of friends that make them feel powerful for the first time, you know, try to sort of find camaraderie in your shared discomfort or whatever that is. It sort of derails teenagers. And for me, I was also dropping out of high school. Like, I was failing in class. I'd always had an attention problem. I'm sure I have chronic ADD, as they've tried to prescribe me many times, but like, my parents are Berkeley parents. They're not putting me on pills. So,
and how were they reacting and responding to the trouble you were finding yourself in?
Yeah.
How were they trying to sort of course correct you?
It got real bad in high school. I think that was like, my pops was sort of a thug growing up in Logan Heights in San Diego, right? Like, he's sort of from Vadio Logan. So he gets like, you ride for your homies, you do your thing. This is a period that you go through in your life. So he was more concerned about like the extreme parts of the danger. He was more just like, am I just making sure that my kid isn't going so hard that he can't come back from this, not going to end up in prison. And so that was the line I felt like he was guarding more. I think my mother was like, you're creative and smart, and you've always had like an overactive imagination. You can do anything if you can just kind of figure out your way through this.
Around that time in his early teen years, Raphael saw the movie Slam, the Saul Williams film about a young man who ends up in the prison system but has a real talent for poetry.
Snorting candy yams that free my body and soul and send me like Shazam. Never question who I am. God knows, and I know God.
I remember sitting there just going like, I could do that. Like, I want to do that. I want to be able to say what I mean like that. And my sister was pushing me to go to these poetry slams. And I went and did that for the first time. I did terribly. But it was this acknowledgement of intelligence and creativity, you know. And in class, I would see the kids who were good at math and history and science and all that, you know, They had had so much help and so much, they were so support. Far ahead of everyone else. And all my friends were kind of like, we're lucky if we get out of here. Mm. You know, let's just try to get through this shit. But over here in this poetry slam, I can excel because it's new for everybody. Mm. And suddenly, like, we're sitting around at home writing and sharing each other's stuff. And I was just so happy that there was a thing that I was good at that pulled me out of the obscurity of just kind of feeling totally lost. Yeah. And the sort of lost space was just me and friends sitting around like drinking and smoking and not going to class and whatever.
The drinking and smoking and not going to class led to Raphael getting expelled from high school as a sophomore. But his interest in poetry had sparked, and he started competing in the local slam scene. He got really good. And at 18 years old, alongside people like Talib Kweli and Kanye West, he was invited to perform on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam in New York City. You did a piece on abortion.
Yeah.
Extraordinary piece. Share with us a little bit about the story behind that poem, what it was about.
I never watched that one.
Hmm.
I don't know why.
Hmm.
It might just be too close to home. I wrote it because maybe a week before I got on the plane to go out there, my girlfriend at the time was like, I'm pregnant and I'm gonna, while you're gone, I'm gonna get this taken care of with my mother. I don't want you to come.
Hmm.
I want you to go do that. So it's just the only thing I could think about, I think, is that I'm like a kid, you know?
How conflicted were you about the choice she was making?
I think it was just the absence of choice. I think it was presented to me as a done deal. And so then I was just sort of forced to just decide how I feel about it, even though it's inconsequential how I feel. I think at the time I was trying to write things that I had never heard out of someone like me's mouth before. So I was like, well, what do I have to offer in this moment? And I think I just ranted. I was like, this is, you know, this is how I feel about fatherhood, and this is how I feel about where my life is.
Swimming backstrokes through Bush's petitions against what we, but ultimately what I am agreeing to do, but I can't be no father. Mother, make me your son again, because I can't do it. Mom, tell her, please, tell her I'm too young for man's shoes. Son, daughter, sorry, but I am not ready for you.
Then I came back. Maybe I was just trying to be dramatic, but I didn't tell my parents what the poem was about. So they found out about it on TV. That was probably like, we were probably still like navigating our distance too.
You know, your parents?
Me and my parents were probably still navigating our...
So you guys weren't close at that time?
We were close, but like I guess we weren't. I guess high school really pulled us apart in a lot of ways. And we were really just trying not to be angry. Because, you know, they didn't understand a lot of my choices of like, well, I'm just not going to fucking go to school anymore. And now I'm going to go get my car and I'm going to do poetry and like, and I'm going to do rap music and that's going to be my life.
But after a few years, that life started to lose its appeal.
God, this can't be it. I don't want to be this like 40-year-old traveling poet person. This was a stepping stone to something else. What is it?
Coming up, Raphael finds a creative partner who helps him figure out what that it could be.
Hey, this is Katie Bishop, producer for Death, Sex, and Money. Mahershala Ali first joined us on the show, along with his wife, the artist Amatus. They talked with our host, Anna Sale, about how they first met as college students and how they reconnected years later, after Amatus had lost several people in her life to gun violence. You can listen to their conversation by texting the name Mahershala to 70101. Mahershala and Amatus also talked about their shared Muslim faith, which includes abstaining from alcohol. And recently, we've heard from a lot of you who are abstaining from alcohol, and a lot who aren't, as part of our call-out about drinking.
My relationship with alcohol can be a challenge to talk about.
It's not a problem for me.
I broke up with alcohol about 2 years and 3 months ago.
I honestly don't want to drink that much anymore.
It provides me some comfort
and solace.
This is what I need to go on dates. This is what I need to have a great night out with my friends.
There's still time to send in a voice memo about whether drinking is working for you or about how your alcohol use is changing. Record your thoughts and send them in to deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. We want to hear from lots of different types of people about this, so please, if you have something to say, send it in. Coming up next on Death, Sex, and Money, Sarah Smarsh, author of the book Heartland. The Kansas author talks with her father, Nick Smarsh, about the values of the world they both grew up in and how those values are changing.
That was one thing that was like ingrained into me, is that we all have a cross to bear. So you pick up your cross and you carry it.
Do you think you're different from your dad in how you look at the world?
No. Are you different than me? No.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor.
She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money. I'm Mahershala Ali, in for Anna Sale. Rafael Casal co-wrote the movie Blindspotting with his creative partner, Daveed Diggs. We'll get to that story of how they connected in just a minute. But by 2014, a decade into their creative partnership, they'd done a lot together. Music, plays, YouTube series. They left the Bay Area and moved to Los Angeles. And they started co-writing the movie script that would go on to become Blindspotting.
We kept almost making it, and then money would fall through, and we'd get a director attached, and they would have to split off to make something else. And, you know, you just get that roller coaster is exhausting, of sort of the universe dangling your dream in front of you. And then David got cast in a show called Hamilton Went to New York.
Wait, first of all, I got to say, I have a quick little story. I was living in New York, and I was there right before Hamilton came out. And I remember I was in like a Starbucks, and there was this girl in front of me who looked like a theater girl, like a musical girl, you know. And she was just describing this musical or workshop she had just come back from. And she was like, yeah, it's all like, you know, historically accurate, but it's like they're rapping, and like she's going on about it. And I thought to myself, I was like, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Like, what is she talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
And then a few months later, this play hit.
Yeah.
I went to see it and I was like, this is genius.
Yeah.
But also, what was your reaction when David explained it to you?
Same reaction he had. He was like, that sounds like a terrible idea, but I'll do it because Lynn and those guys were all his friends.
Someone to bring him to task. Somebody give me some dirt on his vacuous mask so we can at last unmask him. I'll pull the trigger on him. Someone load the gun and cock it. While we were all watching, he got Washington in his pocket.
David went on to win a Tony and a Grammy for his roles in Hamilton. He also got cast in the ABC series Blackish. Basically, his career blew up. But that didn't mean the end of his partnership with Raphael. Okay, let's rewind for a second. 10 years earlier, back to 2004. Raphael was 19 years old, running a music studio in Oakland. David had just recently gotten back to the Bay Area after graduating from Brown University. And one night, he stopped by the studio.
One of his friends was the older brother of one of my friends and was like, hey, Rafa's got a studio. They're looking for artists. You should go over there. And it was like, he sat down. We had a bunch of like goony motherfuckers in the studio. They all left. My guard came down. His guard came down. And we stayed there until 8 a.m. We made like, I don't know, 6-7 songs. Then it was just like, oh, me and David do everything together.
But you had met before that, though. You met
him
in
high school,
right?
Yes.
You just crossed paths.
So he's 4 years older than me. So he was a senior and I was a freshman. So like I knew him and he was in the poetry scene.
Yeah.
He was like a very free spirit dude, like wore pajama pants every day. You know, like he was like the like cool artsy kid.
Okay.
You know, and I think I was like the goony kid who like secretly was an artsy kid.
Yeah. What did, once you and David sort of clicked up, what did you find that you gave each other?
I think then it was just like a lot of co-validation. Diggs was not only doing music, but he was in plays. I knew he came from poetry. He wanted to make weird music. And I was around some real just like hood dudes who wanted to make like trap hood bass shit. And he was like, you know, let's stray over here. And and then, you know, 2 months later, we're like writing a play together. And I think we just realized that someone who can jump between mediums with you but knows you in all the other mediums knows what you can do and can help you find the through line between them.
Which is, and also just
it's a rare gift to have that kind of friend that could sort of be a mirror and validate you in so many different mediums, where it's hard to find people that you just connect with on one of those things that you may do well, let alone being somebody who has.
Do you have anybody like that?
I've found for myself, I didn't, not really. My father was in musical theater, and he died before I started acting, but I was doing poetry at that time and performing my poetry. And
did he get to see you do that?
Yes, he did, which for me told me I wasn't crazy and really helped me locate something in myself. Mm-hmm. But to like come across someone who one perhaps gets what you do, but also does what you do, those are different things.
Yeah.
I have all my friends get what I do, but none of them necessarily do what I do. And so to see what you and David together and individually have accomplished is really inspiring for me, and just so timely, and something that I've needed to see I have an opportunity to move into doing branching out in a real way that reflects old talents or things that haven't been nurtured right in a long time. But so I'm just actually just speaking to how amazing that is that you two have found each other.
We talk about that shit all the time. Yeah. We're just like, we got so lucky.
Yeah.
But the constant now is like, we remember being in a warehouse trying to record on a shitty mic and a shitty computer just to get an idea out. Mm. So when now we're sitting there going like, do we want to do this movie? Mm. We just step back and we're like, this is ridiculous.
Raphael and David are now working on a second movie together after the success of Blindspotting. It even made Obama's list of best movies of the year. But Blindspotting wasn't a Hollywood blockbuster.
We put a movie out and everyone back home thinks I'm on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, that was an indie movie.
Right.
I lost money.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's really hard to explain to people. Like when I'm like, I basically paid to do Moonlight, like between PR, what you get paid and what PR, like, bruh, it was like a college project. You pay to do it in order for that to put you in a different place once you're done with that. Right. Yeah.
But economically, you're still poor.
Yeah. You and David go back many years. And what's hard for you, for the two of you to talk about? Is there a space or subject matter, anything that is challenging for you two to get into?
I think we're both so hypersensitive to the other's comfort that we found really good communication language to bring up things that are just super uncomfortable.
Mm.
Like when we get an offer and my number is so much lower than his, how do we negotiate that?
Hmm.
And what we've created is
how you both individually in a room contribute to something.
Well, something that we're going to evenly work on.
Yes.
But the offer came in huge for him and nominal for me.
Right.
We just sort of discussed early on, like, hey, for stuff we're going to do together, let's just make it even.
Yeah.
We got this other project we're working on, and I was like, hey, man, I really just want my name first on this one because I didn't get it on the last one.
Yeah.
And I just think a lot of people think like Blindspotting was like you and then a little bit of me.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, I did feel that people thought that. So we'll just switch it.
Mm.
Like we just fix it.
Yeah. Do you ever have a moment or any kind of fear of not having your own identity because of working so closely with David, who has a certain type of shine and attention on him as a result of a lot of work that he's put in? You know? But
yeah, absolutely. And I think that was a thing that I think I prepped for hard when we were going to make the movie.
Yeah.
But also, we have this phrase that we say together. We say energy up, expectations down. Mm. That's been sort of the motto of our whole career, is like, we're doing this out of sheer enthusiasm, but we don't really expect to get much. Mm. And I think envy is a hell of a drug, and it's very, very easy to get caught up in it.
Yeah.
I would hate it if somebody I was less close to but partnered with had an explosion and like made money and got all this fame. That might stir me differently. I don't know that I can withstand that with everyone.
Yeah.
But I think what people miss are all the years that Diggs propped me up, you know, as the front man, and was just there. And they don't know that, but I do.
That's Rafael Casal. Look out for him in the upcoming movie, Bad Education, alongside Allison Janney and Hugh Jackman. And this summer, he'll be at the Public Theater in New York, teaching at the Bar's Verse and Theater Workshop that he co-founded with his best friend, David Diggs. And if you haven't seen their movie, Blindspotting, go see it. I can't recommend it enough. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. Our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Emily Nadal. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. And listen, I'm not big into podcasts, but this is one of the good ones. Make sure you subscribe. You can follow me, Mahershala Ali, on Instagram if you're bored.
What scares you about the next 3 to 5 years?
I just don't know what I'm doing. I say this thing all the time that I keep getting through another door and I keep thinking that the adults are in that room. And then I get in there and it's just me and my friends. And we're like, oh, it's the next door. Right. All the grown-ups who know what they're doing are in that room.
I'm Mahershala Ali, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.